City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This program is brought to you in part by American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
And Miller Lite. Triple Hops Brewed Miller Lite. Taste greatness.
About your daughter, cause you're leaving her in real good hands. I'm a real good man. Now the picture of this man is slowly coming into view. Papa, don't you fret and don't forget that one day you was in my shoes. Somehow you paid your dues. Now you're the picture of the man that I someday want to be.
And you're listening to the Windy City Queer Cast, show number 457. I'm Amy Matheny, and what a glorious springtime winter we're having here in February in Chicagoland. And what better to continue to warm things up and heat things up, but to have a fantastic conversation with one of my favorite guests of all time, Lily Tomlin. She's so great. She goes off on these wonderful tangents like somebody I know. Yes. Yes, I really identify with where her brain goes, right and left and up and down. And it's so much fun. And her stories are great. And she's worked with everyone. So she's going to give me the skinny on all the famous stars that she's worked with and knows. Also, we've got a great review from Richard Knight Jr. about our very own Joffrey Ballet here in our backyard and what's going on in the GLBT news and theater scene. It's going to be a big show today with Lily Tomlin. Yeah.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is the Weekend News. Washington State Governor Christine Gregoire signed the newly passed marriage equality bill, telling a crowd at the State House that it means same-sex couples will no longer be separate but equal in Washington, but simply equal. Opponents are expected to mount an effort to force the bill into a referendum, an action that, if successful, could either kill or delay implementation of the new law until December.
Illinois state representatives have filed a much-anticipated marriage equality bill, House Bill 5170, in the Illinois General Assembly. Representatives Greg Harris, Deb Mell, and Kelly Cassidy have introduced the Religious Freedom and Marriage Fairness Act, which would allow same-sex couples to marry in Illinois.
Also in Illinois, State Rep. Kelly Cassidy has introduced a bill in the General Assembly that aims to add gender identity to pre-existing hate crimes law. HB 4725 would amend the Hate Crimes Criminal Code to include gender identity in addition to military status and immigration status.
Rachel Maddow has responded to Fox News pundit Cal Thomas's comment that she should never have been born. Maddow said, "Personally, I'm glad you were born. Otherwise, how would Republicans get the special Fox News bat signal that it's time to be outraged now about what used to be Republicans' own policy idea?" Thomas made the comment at the Conservative Political Action Conference, prompting fellow Fox personality Greta Von Susteren to say Thomas should personally and publicly apologize to Maddow.
In Atlanta, one of three suspects in a videotaped beating of a gay man has been arrested. Christopher Kane, 18, has been charged with robbery and aggravated assault. The men were seen in a video as they shouted anti-gay slurs and physically attacked 20-year-old Brandon White after he stepped out of a JBC grocery store in Delhi. The attackers were believed to be members of a gang called Jack City.
Former HRC and Service Members Legal Defense Network Communications Director Trevor Thomas has filed paperwork to launch his bid for the U.S. Congress in Michigan's 3rd District. Formal announcement will be made in March.
In West Virginia, State Legislator John Doyle has introduced a measure that would provide same-sex couples the same legal protections opposite-sex couples have. Doyle said he introduced the bill February 16th to get people talking about family equality. This is the first time a civil union bill has been introduced in that state's legislature.
Texas A&M University President R. Bowen Lofton added sexual orientation, gender expression, and gender identity to the school's annual non-discrimination employment memo.
In Colorado, a state Senate committee has advanced the civil unions bill by a 5-2 vote. The bill deals with parental rights and even child support when a same-sex couple parts ways. However, the measure faces a challenge in the state House, which Republicans control. Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper recently urged legislators to approve civil unions.
Tennessee's so-called Don't Say Gay measure has advanced in the state House despite protests. The House Education Subcommittee approved the bill, introduced by Republican Stacey Campfield, in a voice vote February 15th. The bill would force elementary and middle schools to ban any mention of sexual orientation besides heterosexuality.
In Virginia, 5 same-sex couples engaged in a Valentine's Day tradition of applying to the Richmond Circuit Court's office for marriage licenses. Also, a gay Massachusetts man asked for his marriage to be recognized in Virginia. For the 8th year, the office rejected the applications because the state doesn't recognize same-sex marriage. However, despite the rejection, Reverend Jeannie Poopke married at least one of the couples, Cameron Hunt and Kayon Heron, in an unofficial ceremony.
Wilton Manors, Florida, officials are concerned about a spike in suicides. There have been 5 or 6 suicides in the city each of the past 4 years, but the numbers translate into an annual rate of 47.3 suicides per 100,000 population, the highest in the country.
In Minnesota, the Anoka Hennepin School Board has dropped a policy that required teachers to be neutral when issues of sexual identity comes up in the classroom. The former policy had the support of some parents who believe homosexuality is immoral. The new policy says that instructors should emphasize the dignity and worth of all students, regardless of religion, race, gender, or sexual orientation.
Illinois Governor Pat Quinn has announced that the state's tourism website has a new section for GLBT travelers. Pride Illinois, your guide to LGBT travel at enjoyillinois.com, has sections such as play, eat, shop, stay. The sections cover items in such regions of the state, such as Great Rivers County and the land of Lincoln, in addition to Chicago. The site provides information about civil unions as well as pride events and parades.
In world news, Uganda's Minister for Ethics and Integrity, Simon Lokoto, shut down a conference for GLBT rights at Exis. Lokoto reportedly accompanied police to the Entebbe Hotel where the conference was being held and ordered officers to evacuate the hotel, causing attendees to flee.
In Thailand, a male couple has broken the Guinness World Book record for longest kiss by smooching 50 hours. Competing couples had to stay in a space measuring 1 square meter, could only intake food and water through a straw, and had to be accompanied by a referee on bathroom breaks. The winning twosome won a diamond ring and a hotel gift voucher.
In entertainment news, Maroon 5 lead singer and The Voice judge Adam Levine has signed Glee star Matthew Morrison to his label, 222 Records. Morrison is the first act on the label, where he will release his second solo CD. Last year, Morrison released his debut, which included duets with Sir Elton John, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Sting.
Glee co-star Lea Michele may be in the big screen adaptation of the Broadway show Spring Awakening. Director McGee said he's talking with Michele to play Windia, the role she played on Broadway from 2006 to 2008.
Matt Bomer, 34, the star of the USA series White Collar, officially came out of the closet at the Steve Chase Humanitarian Awards February 11th, where he was honored with the New Generation Arts and Activism Award for his work in the fight against HIV/AIDS. Bomer's partner is publicist Simon Halls, who also represents Ryan Murphy and Neil Patrick Harris.
Rufus Wainwright's debut opus, Prima Donna, will make its U.S. debut February 19th for the New York City Opera at the Brooklyn Academy of Music for 4 shows only. Wainwright has recorded 10 pop albums, including the upcoming Out of the Game.
Fran Drescher will officiate the marriages of 3 same-sex couples in New York City in support of her Love is Love gay marriage contest. The second season of her TV Land series, Happily Divorced, premieres March 7th.
The full cast of the West Coast premiere of 8, an account of the federal trial of the case to overturn Proposition 8, has been announced. Cast includes Kevin Bacon, George Clooney, Chris Colfer, George Takei, Jane Lynch, Matthew Morrison, Rob Reiner, Jamie Lee Curtis, Martin Sheen, Matt Bomer, and many more. The production, by Dustin Lance Black, will premiere at LA's Wilshire Ebell Theater March 3rd.
Professional poker player Jason Somerville came out of the closet on his blog on Valentine's Day. Somerville took top honors at a No Limit Hold'em event at the World Series of Poker last year, winning almost $500,000. As far as he knows, he is the first male professional poker player at his level to come out publicly.
Director Cheryl Dunye's most recent film, Mommy is Coming, screening at the German film festival Bernal, looks at Berlin's lesbian porn scene. Dunye took the queer film world by storm in '96 with the mockumentary-style movie, The Watermelon Woman.
And among the items at an upcoming British art exhibition is an image of Sir Elton John's face composed with the profile pictures of users of the website Gaydar. The Steve Rosenthal portrait will be part of Gaze, G-A-Z-E, an exhibition of images of inspirational figures from the gay community that includes a specially commissioned portrait of Lady Gaga. The Elton John image is made up of pictures from thousands of men. Gaze will be at London Kensington, March 1st through the 12th. And that's the weekend news brought to you by Windy City Times.
Hello, Deb Pierce here, letting you know that we'd love to hear back from you. So go ahead. You know you want to. Post a comment.
Let's go to the movies anyway and see.
I'm Richard Knight Jr., and here's your Night at the Movies Minute. In Joffrey, Mavericks of American Dance, documentary filmmaker Bob Hercules relates the story of Robert Joffrey, who, along with his partner Gerald Arpino, meshed the worlds of classical ballet and modern dance within their own company. Informative rather than inspirational, the film nevertheless imparts a story that reminds us of the tremendous impact these two gay men have had on the world of the arts and perhaps more importantly in mainstream culture. Robert Joffrey was just 16 when he met the 22-year-old Gerald Arpino in 1945, but already the young wonderkind had mapped out his future, and soon he and his lover headed for New York, where the two worked to become recognized in the field of dance. In 1954, they co-founded the Joffrey Ballet, with Joffrey as its artistic head and Arpino as its principal choreographer and dancer. The duo combined classical and modern dance, bringing quote-unquote culture to the masses, and within time, they gained worldwide recognition. Joffrey's strategy and a series of financial and creative ups and downs are detailed in the film via narration by Mandy Patinkin and archival footage, along with memories and insights related by former dancers, the company, biographers, and dance journalists. By 1965, Joffrey and Arpino were no longer lovers, but continued to live and work together until Joffrey's untimely death at 57 from AIDS in 1988. Arpino then became the company's artistic director, and in 1995, permanently moved the company to Chicago. He died in 2008, just a month after the dedication of the Joffrey Tower in the Loop. The travails and triumphs of the Joffrey's long history naturally lend the film, which is less a movie and more an installment of American Masters on PBS, where it will probably end up, an episodic quality that doesn't allow Hercules' screen time to delve deeply into a lot of personal sidebars, which the movie could have used. But, given the fact that this is the first full-length portrait of Joffrey and Arpino and their company, makes Hercules' approach both understandable and laudatory. The film plays in Chicago exclusively at the Jean Siskel Film Center at 164 North State Street at 8 p.m. on Saturday, February 18th and Wednesday, February 20th, and is also available on DVD for folks outside of Chicago. I'm Richard Knight Jr., and that's your Net at the Movies Minute.
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club.
Dance.
Art. Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Weird.
Innovative. Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of February 20th, 2012, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. Man Boobs is a new dark comedy by J. Julian Christopher, presented by Pride Films and Plays at Mary's Attic. Starring Michael Hampton and Rick Heitz, and directed by David Zack, Man Boobs is playing now through March 10th. For tickets, visit brownpapertickets.com. Man Boobs is unlike any gay play you have ever seen.
When Claudia left Ian and her old life in adult entertainment, she thought she'd found a new start. But when Ian shows up on her doorstep weeks before her wedding to the local youth minister and man of God, everything is thrown into turmoil. Welcome to Hesperia, where everyone has something to hide. Visit writerstheater.org for more. Hesperia is playing at Writers Theater now.
Lifeline Theater continues its 29th anniversary season of Big Stories Up Close with a world premiere adaptation of Hunger, Elise Blackwell's novel about the World War II siege of Leningrad. Hunger runs Thursday through Sunday through March 25th. Tickets and more at lifelinetheater.com.
The Joffrey Ballet ignites Chicago in winter fire with groundbreaking works by the world's hottest choreographers. William Forsythe, in the middle, somewhat elevated, stretches classical ballet to its modern limits. The Tribune called Christopher Wheeldon's After the Rain heart-stoppingly beautiful. And don't miss Wayne McGregor's Infra, a U.S. premiere. For tickets, visit joffrey.org. The Joffrey Ballet's winter fire at the Chicago Auditorium Theater now through the 26th.
And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
Hey, this is Carson Kressley, and you're listening to the Windy City Queercast.
I'm no good at emotional stuff, but this city won't feel the same without your love. Telephone calls will never be enough. Put me inside of your suitcase, we'll try our luck. That's what you said when I left. We were both upset, but now you met someone else and moved on. I'll do everything I can to get to you. I'll fix all the things you want me to. I never wanted you to be sad, so I'll count down every minute. 'Cause all she has on me is better geography.
Comedian, actress, entertainer Lily Tomlin has a prolific career spanning four decades, a winner of 6 Emmys, 2 Tonys, including one for The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, a Grammy, 2 Peabody Awards. She's appeared on such fabulous television shows as The West Wing, X-Files, Will and Grace. And this month, Lily brings her world of rich, insightful, and hilarious characters to Chicago in a show at the North Shore Center for the Performing Arts in Skokie on February 25th. And she may also be coming to a city near you if you're not in Chicago. Hey, Lily, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks a lot.
So I want to go back, and then I've got so much current stuff I want to talk to you about that's happened since you were on last. But why do you think, what was so unique and original about Laugh-In in the early days that really helped you create those seminal characters that you've been performing now for decades of Ernestine, of Edith Ann? Was it just the time and the place and young and fearless?
It must have been a confluence of, astrological harmony or something. I don't know what happened. It was a time. I happened to have those characters just happened to catch on.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, I mean, Ernestine overnight was like a phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I went on the show. I was taping. I didn't even come in until the third year,
yeah.
And all the other people were already big stars. The show was a huge, huge national hit. And, I mean, you couldn't go any place without somebody, you know, throwing a catchphrase at you.
Right.
You know, sock it to me or, and that's the truth and whatever. It just was part of the language.
Yeah.
And so Ernestine, the telephone operator, I took that character to the show and I took the monologue that launched her. And who knew? It's just the right time. The telephone company, everybody hated the phone company. It
right.
was a monopoly. And then she was able to call anybody in the world and she was... You know, she was coming down on that kind of corporate tyranny and
mm-hmm.
And the bureaucracy. Someone like Ernestine being at the switchboard and being able to, you know, put you on hold or disconnect
yeah.
you. So it was just, I don't know, it was just the right time. And it was a character that it seemed everybody could imitate in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's another secret to characters that really catch on. People can imitate them. And their families know exactly who they're doing.
right. So what do you think was different about that kind of success happening so quickly? And as you said, people coming up to you and feeling like they knew you or knew a character you'd created. Is it anything remotely like what it is today when people have this overnight success? Like, I mean, she hasn't had overnight success, but like a Melissa McCarthy, you know, she does Bridesmaids and she's kind of rocketed. Now she's been doing great work with the Groundlings and obviously Gilmore Girls and other television shows. But is it that moment when just the spark ignites? Is it the same now as you think it was decades before?
I imagine it probably is. I can't imagine that it isn't. And then so many more people I mean, you have the internet and everything else, so it's really pervasive. And it, I'm going to sneeze. I'm the worst interview in the world.
Bless
get up,
you.
I open the
no,
door,
I love that. Just, who gets a sneeze from Lily
Tomlin?
The alarm
goes off, I sneeze. Okay. and especially to the individual, I'm sure it feels the same.
Yeah.
Because all the time that's gone before, you don't, that suddenly is telescoped down into that same moment.
Right.
Or it just seems like that's your time or
right.
It happens for you. And it's sort of out of your control. You know, you're giving it your best, but then suddenly something just catches. The right things come together at the right moment. And a critical mass of people are aware of you or enjoy you or something terrific happens. And I think a lot of it is just that. It's sort of luck, circumstance, a million other things. I mean, you have to have some talent and be offering something.
Right.
But I know many talented people that never really quite break through.
Right.
And
So
it's like a roll of the dice, and you get very fortunate, you know.
Well, and you've been really great at shepherding and continuing to produce work. And I've never really thought of you as being in the closet, but I know that when you narrated and executive produced The Celluloid Closet, you know, many people felt like that was, I don't know, a more outward thing that you had done attached to the gay community. It's not really. It was obviously about, it's about film and the story of cinema as well. But has that been important?
I had done many, many things, all through my career, always for gay issues and for women's issues too. And
right.
Because I was certainly, I identified as a female.
Right.
In general. So, I was part of the feminist movement and knew, you know, and lobbied for all that and for women candidates and for shelters and
right.
And for women and their children. And so it was, it was much more treacherous in terms of career in the 70s and early 80s to be out in any kind of blatant way. In fact, when they offered me the cover of Time in 75, if I would come out, first of all, I mean, whether I rationalized it to myself or not, and whether I had the courage to do it, I can't even speak to. But I was able to, because that was a very early time. But I was on the cover of Time 2 years later, just for my work, which was really sort of what I felt I should be on the cover for, not to trade my personal life at that juncture. It was sort of like to me, it would have seemed like, it was like a bribe to get on the cover of a magazine. And I mean, that's what I told myself anyway.
Yeah.
And it was just like when I first was doing Ernestine, the phone company was, they didn't want Laugh-In to use that character. They were afraid it was going to embarrass them or whatever. And then when she hit so positively in terms of the public, then they wanted Ernestine to do commercials. And I literally, that would have been like 1970, I guess, or 71. And I literally burst into tears when someone told me, because I thought I had failed as a satirist, you know. And then so it was a little bit.
They like me. They're not supposed to like me. I'm supposed to be like ruffling their feathers.
Yeah, exactly. So then in the idea that they thought they could buy that character and I was much more I was so idealistic in those days.
Yeah.
I couldn't have possibly have participated.
Right.
So it's all a time. It's all an evolution and a time. And you see what a positive, incredibly substantial thing it was for Ellen to come out in '95.
Right.
On the cover of Time, and it was the right time. Things come along at a certain time, and they really take hold.
Well, and interesting right now, you're talking about the telephone company, you know, wanting you to do commercials for them and Time saying, come out, you know, on the cover of our magazine. And here we have Ellen DeGeneres, who is out and has been signed by a number of companies, and all the recent controversy this week over JCPenney and the people who have protested against the 1 million moms, you know, dot. Well, I don't even want to give them their whatever their dot is, so they don't give me any attention. But who came out against her, saying, you know, well, she doesn't represent traditional family values, and JCPenney's standing behind her. You know, it is a different time, right?
It's more than remarkable.
It's more than remarkable. Well, more than remarkable has been your longtime collaboration in life and work with Jane Wagner. What has made that relationship work in both those arenas, in your personal life and also your work life? Please tell us, those of us who have not made one work.
I wish if I could, I'd write a book. I would write this wonderful, how to. It's nothing but grit, commitment, respect, admiration, fury. It's everything you can possibly have when you're a human to be. Yeah. 40 years or more with somebody, working and living, and in a completely personal and professional partnership.
Yeah.
And it's never easy, but it's almost in my DNA.
Right.
It's just part of, it is me. It is, we are each other in some way, you know.
Yes.
Imagining Jane not being there is very, I'm not capable of it.
Yeah. Well, and of course,
and all you do is you roll. You just have to roll with everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've certainly had our, we've had our professional and personal reversals, but you just get through them.
Yeah. What about the big announcement in California about Prop 8 being found unconstitutional?
It's a remarkable thing and very welcome.
Yeah. Is this something you all will do? Will you walk down the aisle once it all becomes legal?
Did you say would we get married?
Yes.
No, I don't. We might. Sometimes we say, well, maybe we should get get married. You know, just because it would be a good representation and symbol. But I mean, I used to. I even do a line in my show. If all of it, I say I have to confess that I have ambivalence about the issue of same-sex marriage,
mm-hmm.
because if all of us homosexuals start imitating heterosexuals, it could be a very slippery slope.
Yeah, right. Right, indeed.
So, I always make the joke that I couldn't even be sure that Jane would get there on time.
But she would write really amazing vows, They would be she'd write amazing vows and amazing toasts.
Yes, if she wrote them. If I wrote them, they'd be doggerel. But if she wrote them, they'd be interesting.
Well, one of the things I would love is just what your guest list could look like. I want to list, I don't know why we say 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. I think we should say 6 degrees of Lily Tomlin, quite frankly. It would
really?
Probably be less than that. It'd probably be like 2 degrees. But I want to name a few names and just tell me the word that comes to mind, because you have just worked with so many extraordinary people. Bette Midler.
Audacious.
Audacious.
And earnest. I mean, if you can ever combine that kind of audaciousness, and earnestness in the same person.
Mm.
I could tell it, but I see it makes me want to tell a story about each person.
Well, it's go like ahead. It's your time, and we got it. So you go.
When we were doing Big Business,
uh-huh.
Sophie, Beth's baby daughter at that time, who's now grown up and graduated Yale and speaks Mandarin Chinese and all kinds of extraordinary things. At that time, Sophie was about 18 months old or something, and she was a toddler, and you knew she was brilliant. I mean, she'd toddle onto the set, and a camera might be on the floor, and she'd get down and look through the eyepiece. And so one day Beth says to me, Lil, I'm trying to find a nanny for Sophie. And she said, I interviewed this woman. And she said, first thing she said to me was, I'm not responsible for sudden infant death. She said, what? Beth's real in earnest. She's really troubled about it. She says, I was going to interview her again. You think I should? And I said, Ben, no, get a restraining order right away. Because, I mean, she could be the most sophisticated, and she's extremely smart and always reading. And then she'd suddenly come up with something like that, and I would just be floored. She used to just tickle me to death. And it makes you feel very protective
yes.
of somebody who has this kind of innocent streak in them.
Mm.
Okay, that's it.
Which is not what we would think with Bette Midler in Innocent
Street.
No,
so exactly not. And when I finished that movie with her, she gave me a big plaque, you know, that said I had done graduate work at the Midler Institute of Mugging. So, you know, because Bette can. She can, like, her face can move in sections.
Yes.
You know,
I guess
she's going to do a double take.
Yes.
Anyway, put her in heels.
And how can she stop with that cute little prance she has?
Oh, yeah, God, yes.
Okay, Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, what was I going to, I started to say edgy, and that's not Dustin at all.
Mm-hmm.
He's not edgy at all. Here's what's coming in my mind. I'm not being spontaneous. I'm thinking huggy, hunky.
He seems like a love muffin, but I love Tootsie so much. It's like my all-time favorite movie that, you know, I would imagine you all have a simpatico with how deeply he can go into a character, you know?
Yeah.
And his comedic timing.
Well, which movie did you say?
Tootsie is my all-time favorite movie.
Yeah, I see, yeah. Oh, no, and Dustin is, you know, Dustin is an artist, and he just is very involved in his work, and at the same time, he's very playful. And like we were doing one scene and he said, I'm going to play because he didn't have to really do anything in the scene. He was supposed to be sort of distressed but everything else was going on around him. And he said, I'm going to play this like Stan Laurel. he says to me before the scene starts and he just goes, you know how Stan Laurel would cry, like go when Hardy would get on him about something, be exasperated, and Stan Laurel would like get sad and he'd let out a wail kind of. And Dustin just lets out a big wail at the start of the scene and buries himself in my chest, you know, and like as if he's sobbing. And that's how he spent the scene.
Oh my gosh.
So he's also very interested in everybody on the set and trying to fix them up because he has, you know, very attractive children. Not that he's trying to fix them up with his offspring, but he's always worried about who's got a job and who doesn't, and are they going to get a job when they get out of school, and kind of very paternal that way.
Hmm. All right, your sister, Meryl Streep.
Oh, well, divine, sublime, hilarious.
She seems like she has a naughty streak that I would love to go have drinks with her.
Mischievous. She's got she loves to play. And I used to, before every take, I would try to make her laugh, you know, or throw her off guard because we both love that because we want to. And of course, we were making an Altman movie,
sure.
And he welcomes that. Altman never was, he was totally unflappable and totally never, nothing could threaten him or make him, nothing embarrassed him. He would never embarrass you.
Yeah.
It was just a glorious thing for an actor. He used to say to an actor, if he was asked what should I go for in this scene, he would say, I don't know, why don't you surprise me?
Hmm.
And so Meryl, that's right up our alley.
Yep.
And I would, I used to tell this story about my aunt who's in Michigan, who is like totally in earnest, same thing as I was talking about before, but she, I don't know how I can talk about this on this live pod.
Yes, you can say.
Telling this long story.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, you can say any curse word on
our
podcast.
No, I'm not worried about the words. There's no big words. But it's like, but my aunt Irma D would say, like, if somebody was putting her on about something, and she didn't have any sense of irony, you know. But so one time at my mother's girlfriend who was visiting from Detroit, and my aunt Irma D was visiting at the same time, and she's smoking it's hard for me to tell a story without characterizing the whole thing. She's smoking Newports, you know, flicking the ashes in the sink, and her hair's in rollers because she's just always groomed and impeccably dressed. And she's got six big pies on the kitchen table cooling because she's a fantastic cook. And my mother's girlfriend, Teresa, is saying to her all this big stuff about, you know, my son Billy, he's so handsome and so smart, and her grandchildren are Mensa. And they're going to go, and she's really teasing Irma D in a way. And Irma D listens for like 20 minutes, squint-eyed, you know, drawn on that Newport. And then all of a sudden she just says, kiss my ass. So whenever I wanted to make Meryl laugh, I told her that story. And I would suddenly, before the take would start, I'd say,
Kiss my ass.
Irma Dee is Southern, but she came to Detroit, so she got a Southern accent mixed with a Detroit accent, and she married a Polish guy, Walt, and so she had this accent that was inimitable. You could not duplicate it. It was so great. So.
Oh, my gosh. Well, speaking of accents, Dolly Parton, you Southern lady. Southern
friend.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, see, I've got stories about all these people. Dolly, well, my mother lived and died in Nashville,
mm-hmm.
and is buried there now with my dad.
You're
Dolly,
from Kentucky. You were in Kentucky for a while, right? Or have family in Kentucky too?
No, my mother and dad were from Kentucky, and I used to go there every summer. I'd mm-hmm. go from inner city Detroit to rural Kentucky, so mm-hmm. I had a very rich childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dolly would very often be. My mom and Dolly would wind up on an airplane sometimes together coming from Nashville to L.A. And mother just loved Dolly, and she'd say, oh, that Dolly is the cutest thing. She said, and my mother's at this point, she's probably in her late 80s, and she walks with a cane.
Mm-hmm.
So she gets Dolly sitting somewhere behind her in the plane, and my mom gets up to go to the restroom, and Dolly shouts out from behind her. She says, Lily Mae, just sit there and I'll help you get to the toilet. So my mother comes home and tells me that story. So
I've got a friend a long time ago who said they flew on a plane with Dolly Parton and she did not have her wig on. And
really?
Yeah, which I don't know if you've ever seen Dolly without a wig, but said she
I have never seen her without a
said
wig.
Said she had short dark hair, but I don't know.
Yeah,
and had a kerchief over her head and big glasses, and this was years ago. This was like in the early 90s, but
well, she probably thought she's less recognizable.
Sure.
You know,
oh, I think she was until she opens her mouth, you know. He didn't even know, but he was sitting directly next to her in first class. So it was always a funny story. I always thought, how many people have ever seen Dolly without the wig on?
No, this is like a world premiere.
I know, right?
Jane Fonda and I would always, we'd come in to do when we were doing 9 to 5 and I thought, I'm going to catch Dolly this morning, but I never did.
It's like the Loch Ness, you know? It's like
yes,
those. That's
right, right. Anyway, she's another one that's just out of sight.
Yeah. So, Glenn Close, I want to hear your work on Damages was just amazing. I love that series so much. And I have to say, I've missed the last season once it went to DirecTV, but you were nominated
right.
for an Emmy. I mean, it was such an exciting season with Martin Short and Campbell Scott and Lynn Carew, is that how you pronounce
Carew,
it?
Carew, yeah.
Carew did Sweeney Todd, the original Sweeney Todd. I mean, just Glenn Close.
Well,
I mean,
well,
talk
heard.
To me about that, because that just, she's also nominated for an Oscar along with your friend Meryl Streep this year.
Yeah, no, I know.
What can you tell me about Glenn?
If only I was nominated, there'd be three of us. Okay, so, well, Glenn is great. All these people they're special
yeah.
in some fashion. Glenn has one of these great laughs that is so girly and so musical. And Marty and I, when the first scene we did was her character was deposing us.
Right.
And he was my lawyer. And so in between takes, Marty and I would say, this next take, you do it as Ernestine, and I said, you do it as Ed Grimley.
Well, I mean, such
we wanted to make Glenn laugh, you
yeah.
know, because she would laugh so great.
Yeah.
Now, Meryl's another one that has a great laugh, and
yeah.
she whoops.
Yeah.
She whoops really loud, and
yeah.
She even snorts sometimes. It's
yeah.
Just,
but
just,
so exciting for you and Martin Short. I mean, I just wouldn't think... I mean, you've done a ton of dramatic work, so I'm not saying that, but I just thought for both of you, how exciting to be on that show, and that show
no,
just
loved
had
it.
Such
we loved
rich
it. We
characters.
And but the best part about Damages is you never knew how bad you were.
Yeah, right?
From week to week, and because the writers kind of write, they know where they're going, in a sense. They have a big, you know, some kind of armature for the season.
Right.
But they, you know, they kind of write as it goes. And we would stand around the first 5 or 6 weeks, Marty and Campbell and I, and we'd say, like, how far do you think, how far would Marilyn go? Do you think she would kill Joe, her
right.
son? You know,
right.
would Marty kill Marilyn?
We just weren't sure who was it really bad and who wasn't.
But isn't it interesting to be in that gray? It's so human. It's so people to do, because everybody has to be the villain or the protagonist, the antagonist, and somewhere in the middle is the truth, right?
Yeah, Amy, it was as an actor, it was divine.
Mm.
Because I think it really layers, you know, the performance stays layered, because as an actor, you want to leave every possibility open
right.
for this character.
Right.
And I don't know, I found it very exciting and fun. And I was a huge fan of the show anyway, so
yeah.
I was delighted when I got a bid to be on it.
Oh, how exciting is that? I mean, you really have been able to come into some really exciting shows, West Wing kind of similarly.
Yeah, same thing. I loved being on that show. And when it came on the air, I said, how could I not be on this show? What? How could this have happened to me?
Exactly.
Because it was so good, and the great ensemble cast and production, and it was so much about something, especially
mm-hmm.
during that era.
Yeah.
When we had the Bush administration,
right.
It was a contrast to that. And anyway, yeah, that was another divine opportunity I had.
There are so many voices now, so many more funny women writers, funny men, funny women comedians today. You're working with Lisa Kudrow, who's found a new avenue for herself with web therapy.
Right.
I mentioned Melissa McCarthy a little earlier. Who do you look to? Who are you inspired by? And do you think, wow, those are the young women today that I'm so excited are on the scene?
The ones you've mentioned, and Kristen Wiig, I've always been a great fan of hers since she appeared on SNL.
Yes.
And, of course, Tracy predates her, but Tracy is phenomenally talented.
Tracy
Ullman.
Yeah, of course. Brilliant. I mean, I think she really tips her hat to you. For, you know, in the
it's all, we're all in the line just, you know,
mm-hmm.
the line starts back there and then comes forward.
Yeah.
And, but they're wonderfully talented, wonderfully funny. And, but see, women, there are many more women. I've got a big story for this one too, but, I'm going to talk your ear off here because all I do is free associate. And
I love it. Go for it.
Well, when I was in my 20s and coming up, very few women did comedy.
Right.
And certainly character comedy. The few women that did comedy, stand up, you could count on your hand.
Right.
And then there were some women that had TV shows or they did comedic parts in movies. But there was not a lot of women. There were certainly not a lot of women writing comedy and producing comedy, and there were very few women doing stand-up
right.
or creating that kind of persona. And now there's just so many, and there's so many that are so good and expressing, you know, female points of view and as well as very universal points of view. But I used to tell this story because I was in a review at the upstairs at the downstairs, and there was a girl, and traditionally in those old cabaret reviews, there was a leading lady, a character woman, and an ingenue. And then there were the three boys that were the male counterparts.
Right.
And the ingenue was always very bland, boring, because that's the role of an ingenue. And I used to say, and the girl who was the ingenue in this show, she was so boring on stage, but so funny off stage. I'd be in the dressing room with her, and she'd be telling me some story. I'd be doubled over, just screaming. It would be so wonderful. And she'd characterize things, and I'd say, oh, you've got to do that on stage. And she'd pull herself together, and her hair would, like, expand on its own. She'd look in the mirror, and she'd get herself all back beautiful. And she'd say, oh, I wouldn't want anyone to think I was unattractive. Literally.
Wow.
And that's how it went.
Yeah,
there was a real taboo against women doing comedy, and that's why so many were either supposed to be overweight or be scatterbrained or be homely or be this or be that, because a pretty woman doing comedy was like uncomfortable, considered,
right.
you know, not that there weren't some people, there certainly were,
sure.
certainly in the movies, Kay Kendall and lots of people.
Well, in the early days, Mary Tyler Moore would even be seen. I mean, she was not really a stand-up comedian, but...
But she, that's, well, that, and I mean, many women had shows, you know.
Right.
Joan Davis, Lucy, even Lucy.
Right,
but
sure.
Lucy used to be, you know, was always doing something scatterbrained or whatever.
Right.
But anyway, it wasn't, because standing up and telling jokes, supposedly, I never understood this philosophy, but it was like, it was too controlling, too powerful. Because if you laugh, you're vulnerable, supposedly.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And it probably is true. I mean, you do have, I mean, because someone's touching you in some way.
Yeah.
So, anyway, women just didn't do it. There was only Toni Fields, Joan Rivers, Phyllis Diller. Who else was there in the day?
Yeah, not really.
And I was very influenced by a woman named Jean Carroll,
mm-hmm.
who in the early 50s was on Ed Sullivan and only just died a couple of years ago. She was almost 99.
Mm.
And Joy Behar and Carolyn Ray and some other women, we honored her at the Friars Club. And she came out from the East, and she, I guess we had it in the East. I can't remember. There's a Friars Club on the West Coast, too. But anyway, I said, and she got up and did 10 minutes. She was still very attractive. She was always attractive. She always wore a cocktail dress and sometimes a cocktail hat, sometimes a mink stole when she was on Ed Sullivan. And she'd tell husband jokes, which you just didn't see, you know, husband jokes and kid jokes and sort of satirize and poke fun at, you know, the like a Long Island matron sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother would just laugh. I can remember just laughing with my mother and enjoying watching my mother laugh because she would do all these wife and mother jokes.
Mm.
You know, and she was so there was a, she was she had a little subversiveness in her. Okay, that's enough. I'll tell a long story. Everything you ask me, I'll tell you a story.
I love it. Well, hey, I never mind somebody telling me too much. You just hate the one word answers. It's we're here to learn about you. Tell me what people can expect who are coming to the show at the North Shore Center of the Performing Arts in Skokie. You're doing two shows in one night. So you're going to do a marathon that day. That's a lot. Are people going to see your classic characters? When do you decide if you ever add new characters new scenarios to your classic characters?
Well, new scenarios. I do that quite a bit. Some things I do, I'll do a lot of characters. So probably do 10 or so, 12, maybe whatever comes up, but then I'll try to talk about Skokie and Chicago and the area and being on, you know, all of us being on Spaceship Earth here together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very intimate, more interactive than if I were doing a theater piece.
Right.
And I use video. I put video things together, you know, that sort of to satirize something or to make fun of me as a celebrity or stuff that the characters might interact with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mrs. Beasley might talk to you about one of her early endeavors and then bring you up to date and so on.
Now, are there projects right now that I know you said earlier when we were talking, I mentioned you producing, executive producing The Celluloid Closet and that you'd been producing and lending your name to women's causes and LGBT causes, you know, for many decades. But I do know that you find projects and champion them or find artists and champion, mentor, help shepherd projects. Is there anything you're working on right now or that you're really lending your passion to give voice to LGBT artists and stories?
Well, nothing profoundly new, but there's at the Gay Center here in LA, Jane mm-hmm. and I, our names are on the Cultural Arts Center that's there.
Yep.
Someone made a very large donation in our names, and we've been involved with that for several years. And there are two theaters there, a small theater, a black box, and then a very nice 300-seat theater, and there's an art gallery and stuff. So that's because at the Gay Center, there are two locations. One is the original, very big building. I think L.A. maybe one of the first, and probably one of the largest in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But that serves medical and housing and employment and more serious things like that, day-to-day mm-hmm. life. And then we have an adjunct called The Village, where we have the theaters and an art gallery and lots of other things, all kinds of classes, computer classes, mm-hmm. support groups, and, you know, it's more of a social community get-together place.
Yeah.
So we've been involved with that, and we've always been proud of being a part of that. And other stuff just comes along. I mean, I'm sure there'll be candidates that I'll I'll be trying to do stuff for.
Right. Well, know. Living your life and just living your truth and living your joy in these characters and being on this planet Earth with us and taking us along has just been a gift to the community in general. And we just are so excited that you're going to be coming here to Chicago. Do not miss Lily. I saw her the last time she was here a couple of years ago. And it is such a wonderful night to come into a theater space with her and let her guide us through laughter and sometimes just some profound ideas and great joy, and to come together and laugh with people. It's such a powerful gift. One night only, but two shows. There's a show at 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock, both happening on February 25th in Skokie at the North Shore Center for the Performing Arts in Skokie. If you'd like tickets, call 847-673-6300, or you can visit the website, which we'll have linked in our notes, northshorecenter.org. I hope you will make it. And Lily may also be coming to a town near you. She's got a lot of dates coming up in the upcoming months. So you can go to lilytomlin.com. She's got a very fun website there with all kinds of archives and also what's new in her life and thoughts and musings, photos, and also what her tour schedule is. So check out lilytomlin.com, which we will also link in our show notes.
Oh, and I meant you're so nice, Amy. Thank you for all that. But I do remember something we've been working on. I'm launching a new website in a few weeks.
Good.
And we won't lose our old website. It'll be there for posterity.
Mm-hmm.
But and in conjunction with that, we've also been working on some little Edith Ann games for, you know, children.
Uh-huh.
You know, electronic games. So
Fun.
And they should be, you know, launched at some point soon.
Excellent. Lily Tomlin apps is what you're talking about, right?
Yes, or Edith Ann app.
Edith Ann apps. That's fantastic. Well, check out all of those and put her on your smartphone and for your kids and for yourself. Edith Ann, wouldn't you love to just take Edith Ann? I just want my phone to like go, like when I answer. Wouldn't that be fun? I mean, it's going to be a ringtone.
Yeah, that would be good.
Make that my ringtone on my iPhone. I'm for it too. Thanks so much, Lily.
All right. Thanks, Amy. All the best.
Got something to say? Call us today. 312-21-BE-GAY. Well, everybody, I hope you continue to stay warm and sunny, because if you're in the Chicagoland area, this is a winter unlike any I've ever known in my 15, 16 years of living here. So I'm enjoying it a day at a time. The sunshine at least makes everything that might not be going right a little bit sunnier. Thanks, everyone. Have a good week. Thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. Special thanks to our Queercast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueercast.com and iTunes. The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast. Queer and now.